radio free. You see blue skies and think of sea. How are you doing? And later on, switch on TV. They give me the news, they give half truths to me. They give us wise, they feed us lies. How are you doing?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Educate, they fabricate. And we sit back till
Rick Adams is on.
Yes, I am, and hour number two here with Thomas K. Kimmel. And let us get right back to it. Tom, go right ahead. Continue, please.
I was going to finish up with Harry Dexter White, and then I was going to move on to Harry Hopkins.
Right.
Men of great influence in the Pearl Harbor story.
Well, he sure was.
November 26, 1941, the document that touched the button that started the war, the document that was never revealed to Admiral Kimmel. The Chief of Naval Operations was asked about it by the Naval Court of Inquiry. And it said, I do not recall having seen, this is Admiral Stark testifying to the Naval Court of Inquiry, I do not recall having seen the November 26, 1941 American note or having heard anything about it. I haven't the slightest recollection of that note. Well, that's his testimony. It seems fair to ask, how is that possible? So let's analyze it. 1981, we found out that Admiral Stark's naval aide, Admiral Smedberg, then a commander, kept a wax cylinder recording of everything President Roosevelt said to Chief of Naval Operations Stark. He monitored nearly every telephone conversation Stark had, and he made a recording of them. Secretary of State Cordell Hull called Stark and said, Admiral, I'm afraid the fat's in the fire. It's up to you military fellows now. I heard the conversation. It was on one of those wax cylinders. I broke up. Now I wish I hadn't destroyed them. Okay, we didn't find this information out until 1981, even though apparently Smedberg, in a letter to Gordon Prang, explained the whole thing to him. But Gordon Prang decided he would leave it out of his book. That would be Donald Goldstein, Gordon Prang's book, Pearl Harbor, The Verdict of History. At any rate, we continue on with this saga. Stark claiming he never saw the November 26, 1941 American note. And then amazingly, in 1946, before the Joint Congressional Committee, 2 years after Stark's testimony to the Naval Court of Inquiry, the Joint Congressional Committee didn't think it was possible either that Stark hadn't seen it. Gerhard Gesell asked Stark, the evidence here shows that that note, Hull's note, was intercepted in the regular course and was among the Japanese intercepts. In other words, the text of the note being transmitted by the Japanese representatives here in Washington to Tokyo. Admiral Stark says that is true. I think that was on the 28th. Gesell says, do you think you saw it then on the 28th? Stark says, I could not be sure. I would like to say with regard to that 10-point note, while not recollecting it, having seen it at that time, that I had discussed in the State Department a memorandum by Mr. Morgenthau. Recall, it's written by Harry Dexter White, and expressed my opinion on it and confirmed it in writing. The note of November 26, the 10-point note, as I recall, contained nothing, or at least very little or only minor differences from the note of the Secretary of the Treasury and also did not contain anything which I had objected to in the other note. So in general, I knew of the substance of that note, but as to having seen it in its actual form when it went out, or whether I saw it on the 28th, I could not say. Rick, as an investigator, note well, Stark said he expressed his opinion on Harry Dexter White's memo and confirmed it in writing. The investigator in me must ask, Judge Gazelle, why didn't you ask for that writing? Oh, my, oh, my. Onward. Why in the world Stark decided he was going to volunteer that information? It's mind-boggling to me. But we have to go on here. J. Edgar Hoover, in 1945, wrote to, let's see, how did this work? May of 1945, Soviet spy Whitaker Chambers detailed to the FBI the Soviet spies in the State Department, in the White House, and the Treasury Department, to include Harry Dexter White. The Chambers' 1939 warnings were ignored, apparently. The November 7th, 1945, Soviet spy Elizabeth Bentley identified Harry Dexter White as a Soviet spy. Mm-hmm. November 8th, this is the next day after Bentley came forward, Hoover sent a memo to Truman concerning the spies to include Harry Dexter White. Obviously, the FBI knew about Harry Dexter White spying in 1945. I have no idea if the Joint Congressional Committee did, although, as I was trying to explain, I think I got cut off on this. There's a very interesting point about all of this Harry Dexter White and the Joint Congressional Committee. None of the investigations, the nine official investigations that took place in Admiral Kimmel's lifetime, mentioned Harry Dexter White in any form, with one exception, and that is on the memorandum that Harry Dexter White wrote for Secretary Morgenthau are contained Harry Dexter White's initials, HDW. But apparently nobody in the Joint Congressional Committee asked the question, who's this HDW, who obviously had written the letter for Morgenthau. Morgenthau didn't write the letter. Harry Dexter White wrote the letter. But there's no indication that Harry Dexter White was interviewed or even thought about through any of the nine official investigations when Admiral Kimmel was alive. None of this appears in any Pearl Harbor tribunal. And of course, verifying Harry Dexter White's espionage was not declassified until 1995. And when I say verifying it, I'm now talking about Venona, which is where we should go next in all of this. Mm-hmm. Although, of course, it's important to know that Hoover's memorandum to Truman was ignored. 1946.
In this context, too, let's not forget that Truman, that administration, inherited the communist spies of the Roosevelt period, and where he came from, Truman, you know, the Missouri mob, so to speak, he made it a point of fact to christen Joe Stalin as Uncle Joe. And, he wasn't about to confess to being a president over this regime in Washington that lied us into World War II and did so at the behest of the Soviet apparatus. I mean, I just couldn't imagine Harry Truman being that honest, you know, honest Harry. He really wasn't to that extent. So I just wanted to once again lay that backdrop so people will know the involvement and the fact that Truman himself, had made it a point to do some pretty nefarious things. And he ignored the advice of generals, as you know, even with the dropping of the bomb. He ignored even Eisenhower's advice, and others as well, you know, Admiral Halsey and so forth. So, as I said, I wanted to add that footnote. Go ahead, Tom.
I have to parlay off of what you just said there about Truman when he was a senator, but maybe I should finish this thought first.
Well, right ahead.
In 1946, Truman ignored Hoover's warning about Harry Dexter White, and Hoover was saying this man should not be appointed to head the International Monetary Fund, and identified by the 1991 Soviet temporary release of their files after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And Truman was also worried that pursuit of Venona would be politically damaging to the Democratic Party, which, of course, it would have been. But it's just outrageous that the Venona take was kept classified until 1995. Robert Lamphere, who was the FBI agent who was the prime mover in the investigations of Venona, when the Army Security Agency eventually decided that they had to go get some sort of action. They had all this intelligence information, but they couldn't do anything with it. So they finally decided they better go to the FBI, because the FBI has the authority, working with the Department of Justice, to do something about it. In other words, to prosecute some of these guys. And so they eventually did that. Interestingly, they did it. I'm trying to remember the exact date they did it, but I'm not coming up with it. But they refused to give it to CIA for quite a while because there were so many infiltrations of the CIA that they decided that we'll keep the CIA out of this thing for a while. Yeah. Anyway, Robert Lamphere told me before he deceased, and again, he was the prime mover in the investigation, in the criminal investigation of these fellows. Ladies, too. I shouldn't just say fellows. He told me that the FBI was through with their investigations of this Venona take in 1980. They were done. The FBI was done with it. And he could not understand why they refused. Authorities above Robert Lamphere refused to make Venona public. Because, of course, that would be another good way to try and advance the investigations, make this stuff public. Well, the reason they didn't make it public is because politically it could have been damaging to the political party. And, of course, most of this happened during the Democratic Party's reign, so that's where the greatest danger lay. But the fact that it remained classified until 1995 is really a sorry commentary.
Well, and we can't leave out the Eisenhower role in all of this, too, because he came in. Remember, he was a Democrat who suddenly became a Republican following the war, the so-called hero status and all of that. And when McCarthy came along, he had information that was given to him by FBI agents that the FBI could not advance on. You know, the Justice Department didn't give the go-ahead. And McCarthy has been vindicated over and over and over again. But Eisenhower allowed, again, for an executive order following the McCarthy hearings, that the State Department would not be investigated again. And those people who were in the State Department, many of them advanced to other careers, shall we say. Many of them were allowed to retire without any prosecution whatsoever. And this I have gleaned from the historical records myself. But I just wanted to add to it, it wasn't just Roosevelt and Truman, as you point out. It continued on until the early 90s. Okay, go ahead.
Well, you're certainly right with the great attacks on the Wisconsin Senator McCarthy. That was all orchestrated by Eisenhower.
Yep.
All right, well, we continue on here. Venona. Venona was the American program to break Soviet spy cables sent from the United States to Moscow Center from 1939 to 1948. About 2,900 cables were actually broken, which only represented about 10% of the take. The program was really started in 1943. It was compromised in 1948 by a Soviet spy in the Army. It ended in 1980, as I mentioned, at least in the United States. In the UK, they kept it going for a longer time. It identified some 349 American spies, of which a little less than half were identified by true name, and a little more than half were only identified by cover name. And it wasn't declassified until 1995, declassified, which, of course, is horrific. Harry Extra White is identified several times in Venona intercepts, some dozen times, as I recall, using the code name Richard. And he was actually given some compensation for his spying. Again, it was identified by Elizabeth Bentley and Whittaker Chambers.
Mm-hmm.
He was identified in a review of Soviet KGB notes of the NKVD, official Gak Oviakimian. So there's just no doubt about the fact this guy was a Soviet spy. Operation Snow was the name given to this Soviet operation to further corrupt Harry Dexter White and advance the hard line that the Soviets wanted the United States State Department to continue with Japan. Interestingly enough, a lot of the big players in Operation Snow were gathered together to plan this thing. And in January of 1941, Oviakimian, who was the New York NKVD resident, he's the one who suggested that Harry Dexter White be used, one of Ikshak Akhmerov's many illegal conquests. Akhmerov was the legendary Soviet illegals officer who was able to corrupt Americans left and right. Oviakimian suggested using Harry Dexter White, and the director of foreign intelligence for the NKVD, Pavel Fitton, he actually wrote a memo, which the Soviets call a spravka, June of 1941, laying out how they should proceed. There was a lot of internal discussion about this, resulting in a couple of the Soviet officers being murdered, fear they would compromise the operation. Mm-hmm. Eventually, it went to Beria, the head of the NKVD, and Stalin, and they approved it. So, off Vitaly Pavlov goes, May of 1941. It just wasn't a shot in the dark. These fellows planned this thing well. And as the 2002 Russian trade magazine reported itself, the Russians actually describing Operation Snow in their own trade magazine, Harry Dexter White was acting in accordance with a design initiated by Akhmerov and Pavlov. The essence of Operation Snow was to provoke the war between Japan and the United States to ensure the security of the Soviet Union. Now we come to Venona spies in the Treasury Department. I identify 11 of them from the book Venona by Haynes and
Include, all right, of course. We have that music again, break time on RBN. Tom, you get a little rest and take a breath. We'll come back with more, folks. Fascinating stuff. Listen up, Rick Adams on Uncensored.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel, with all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing: knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
Without the right accessories, any guy can be off the mark. Whether you've invested thousands in your arsenal or you own a single trusted firearm, a visit to AROutfitting.com is in order. It's one of the finest online selections of tactical optics and AR parts and add-ons, like EOTech, quick target acquisition with no peripheral loss. Browse the full range of Nikon scopes and binoculars. AROutfitting.com can illuminate your world with streamlight gun-mounted lights from keychain to large handhelds, up to 1,100 lumens. Find some stability with Battenfield tactical bipods. AirOutfitting.com has CMMG gun parts, barrels, assemblies, handguards, part kits, and more. Plus Magpul clips and magazines. I know I've got you excited, so take a breath. Head to AirOutfitting.com. The site's super easy to navigate and features a ton of technical info, including links to manuals. We also welcome vendor and manufacturer inquiries. Remember, if you don't see it, we can get it. At AROutfitting.com.
Haven't you got any respect for this town?
I just lost it.
Thank you very much for that added commentary. All right. We're back now with Tom Kimmel, and this is, like I said, a really highfalutin, very important program today of historical note. And it certainly does apply more appropriately to current times. You know, there's nothing new under the sun. So let's get right back, Tom, to the point where we left off. Go ahead, sir.
Well, what we're trying to do is establish the magnitude of the Soviet espionage problem in the United States.
Yes.
Married extra white, of course, is the prime problem from the Pearl Harbor perspective. And I've spent a lot of time explaining Harry Dexter White's role. It continues throughout the war, but of course the one I'm particularly interested in was his involvement with the Pearl Harbor attack, which was substantial. In his note, and I'll call it his note since he wrote it in the first two iterations, when it was finally received by the Japanese, they wrote their own version of the note. And they called it, in a magic dispatch, which we intercepted on November 28th, they called it a humiliating proposal, quite unexpected and extremely regrettable. The imperial government can by no means use it as a basis for negotiations. The negotiations will be de facto ruptured. This is inevitable. I think that might have been helpful to Admiral Kimmel to have that information. Of course, he never got
it. Yeah, so it would have been very important. That's
so
why
what
it was
what was the magnitude of the Soviet espionage problem? Let's just start in the Treasury Department. We have 11 identified spies, to include Harry Dexter White. And, of course, Harry Dexter White is identified by Chambers, Isaac Levine, whether it was identified by the Secretary of State, Adolf Borel, that's still some question. But we have 13, and the funny aspect of this, if funny is the appropriate term here, it kind of hits me as amusing. In 2012, Robert Benson, who was a retired National Security Agency Venona expert, gave a talk at his local library in Northern Virginia, and he said Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau Jr. was surrounded by spies. When he walked into his office Monday morning, he would not have seen anyone who was not a Soviet spy. I find that amusing, but of course it's also tragic.
Yes.
It doesn't stop there. As you had mentioned earlier, Venona spies in the State Department, we have some 22 listed. This is just the Venona spies. And several of them previously had been identified by Chambers. In China, the NKVD had Chiang Kai-shek covered like a blanket. And Launchlin Curie, President Roosevelt's personal assistant, he was clearly identified as a Soviet spy and eventually took flight after the Senate Armed Services Committee or the Un-American Activities Committee called him out, and he decided it was better to take flight and spend the rest of his days in South America, out of the reach of American justice. Curie, Launchlin Curie, assistant to the president, appears in Venona cables under the cover name of Page and in Soviet intelligence archives as VIM, that's V-I-M, and as a member of both the Golos and Bentley spy networks. Curie actually tipped off Soviet spies or Soviets about Venona. The first indication that the Soviets had that we were breaking their spy communications actually came from President Roosevelt's assistant, Launchlin Curie. Eventually, it was also given up by several others, British spies, and another American spy who was also identified in the Venona take, William Wiseband. He compromised Venona to the Soviets. But Curie did it in the first instance. And in the military and war production, we have some 26 Soviet spies identified through Venona. So it's a pretty sad commentary. Launchlin Curie was famous for a lot of nefarious things, but one was secretly funding the Flying Tigers in China.
I was just going to mention that. Yeah, yeah.
We have that famous memorandum that Launchlin Curie wrote for President Roosevelt's signature and his approval. And he, Roosevelt did approve Americans flying combat missions in China. This is, of course, all before Pearl Harbor.
We have a break again, Thomas, so we'll put you to rest for a minute. We'll come right back, folks. Rick Adams Uncensored. And we will do that in just about 3 minutes.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855, the number 2, keep it today.
Tired of being lied to by mass media? It's growing more and more apparent today that news is received less and less through standard media outlets, even with a growing audience every day. RBN is beginning to direct more efforts into social media. Social media and the use of the internet is fast becoming the primary source of people for news, regardless of demographic. RBN has set out to provide some of the best news on the internet through republicbroadcasting.org, and also has begun to use the tools to our advantage by way of social media. Republic Broadcasting is now operating a Facebook page to function as yet another avenue to have our collective voice reach new audiences across not only America, but across the globe as well. The Facebook page features not only news, but also an RBN player to listen to our broadcast. Get involved by visiting facebook.com/republicbroadcasting and liking our page, and share it with your friends and family, because you can handle the truth.
The reviews for Extendivite are amazing. Here are some from Amazon. September 2018. Extendivite works in keeping my blood pressure in the normal range. I've been using Extendivite for many years now. May 2018. Great product. I use regularly and I rarely get sick. March 2018. This product has relieved what appeared to be angina pain in my chest and shortness of breath after climbing stairs. I'm quite happy about it. February 2018. My husband, son, and I have been using this product for a few months now, and we have noticed an improvement in our joints and blood pressure. Tell us your story. Get Extendivite today. To order, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822, or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
By some awful quirk of fate, the Morlocks had become the masters and the Eloi their servants. The Morlocks maintained them and bred them like cattle.
All right, hey, fellow Eloi, don't forget that Andrew Carrington, Hitchcock.com is also a site you can access any time of day or night for the latest weekday interviews that Andrew Carrington Hitchcock does, okay? And don't forget Rick Adams Uncensored and The Deadly Experiment YouTube. Now back to Tom Kimmel, and we have quite a bit of time here, Tom. I'm going to give you the whole program because you are so enlightening, and this is very, very important to know, because where we have been is where we're going again. And we need to be aware that this enemy within, as you cited early on, has not just walked away and left the premises. So let's continue. Go right ahead.
Well, Rick, I should emphasize that right now. I usually end my talks by saying, what's changed from all of this Soviet espionage? And the answer, the short answer is nothing's changed. Which is sad, but it's a statement of fact, and we have to come to grips with it. Okay, my next victim, if you will, is Harry Hopkins. Harry Hopkins is difficult to deal with because we can't prove absolutely or beyond a reasonable doubt, let me put it that way, that Harry Hopkins was a Soviet spy. Mm-hmm. He might just have been a dupe. But the truth of the matter is, what difference does it make?
Amen.
Anyway, the case against Harry Hopkins, I suppose, starts with a Venona intercept identifying him as Agent 19. And the Venona investigators even wrote a note on the Venona intercept, which says, a May 1943 message from illegal resident Ikshak Akmera to Moscow, revealing that Agent 19, later identified as Harry Hopkins, had reported on a meeting between Roosevelt and Churchill at which he was present. Well, of course, that's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It's certainly suspicious, but it's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, the fact that Harry Hopkins is even meeting with an illegal is about all the proof that most counterintelligence investigators need, but we continue. Harry Hopkins' pro-Soviet activities are substantial and probably speak for themselves. Harry Hopkins, who was in charge of Lend-Lease, which is very important, he gave excessive largesse towards the Soviets via Lend-Lease, clearly sacrificing American needs. And Admiral Kimmel was on record as saying, objecting to the fact, to Chief of Naval Operations Stark, that Kimmel couldn't believe that we were giving this vital material to the Soviets when his needs in Hawaii were so great. But that fell on deaf ears. Harry Hopkins was also dedicated to Stalin's Second Front demands, opposing alternatives less advantageous to Stalin's expansionist designs in Eastern Europe, detailed in the 1939 Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact with the Nazis. In other words, opening up a second front in France, as opposed to going after areas much closer to the advancing Soviets. And we laid Eastern Europe wide open to the Soviets. That's what they're referring to with that one. Mm-hmm. Harry Hopkins dismissed the idea that the Katyn Forest massacre of 22,000 Polish officers was actually done at the behest of Stalin and not Hitler. As we subsequently learned, it was a function of the Soviets, not of the Germans. Labeling defector Viktor Kavachenko a deserter when Kavachenko was trying to help us out, Harry Hopkins was doing his best to get Kavachenko return to Stalin and certain execution.
Sure.
The biggest one is the facilitation, Hopkins' facilitation of uranium shipments to Russia, which kind of sounds familiar with today's politics, but at any rate, that's a pretty bad
mm-hmm.
one.
Mm-hmm.
And the most compelling, maybe, was Harry Hopkins personally compromised the FBI's electronic surveillance of NKVD resident Vasily Zarubin and Steve Nelson. What I consider to be maybe the most compelling comes from Major Jordan of Major Jordan's Diaries.
Yes.
A remarkable little book written in 1952. Major Jordan was Harry Hopkins' designated facilitator of Lend-Lease, all kinds of Lend-Lease off the books at the orchestration of Harry Hopkins, who was going to the Soviets. Jordan writes in his diaries and spent the remainder of his life lecturing, I guess very much like I do, about what Harry Hopkins had done and the threat that he saw personally. Because Major Jordan was indeed on the scene facilitating these secret flights to Russia. He writes, planes were arriving regularly from Moscow with unidentified Russians aboard. I would see them jump off planes, hop over fences, and run for taxi cabs. They seemed to know in advance exactly where they were headed and how to get there. It was an ideal setup for planting spies in this country with false identities for use during and after the war. And this is the catch line. Why screech about Russian atomic bomb espionage when Washington itself had delivered to the Soviet Union uranium under Lend-Lease? That's quite an indictment of Harry Hopkins. Now, whether he's doing this as a result of a true loyalty to Roosevelt or to the Soviets, or I don't know, but the effect is the same.
And don't forget, yeah, and Harry Hopkins had been quoted quite frequently in the media as actually saying that you can tax and tax, spend and spend, elect and elect, but the American people are too damn dumb to understand. And so, you know what? As you said, they were dumb then, and they're dumb now to some great extent. However, now we have the benefit of the Internet, and barring any censorship or interdiction of it, we do have the opportunity to have a greater knowledge of what happened then than they did at that time. So we're thankful for that. But Harry Hopkins, I'll tell you, if he wasn't a Soviet agent, he surely could have applied. Let's put it that way, John.
Well, I'm getting back to that protest by Kimmel in Hawaii. It was actually July 30th, 1941, where Kimmel formally protested the supplying of aircraft to the Russians when our own deficiencies are so great here in Hawaii. That was followed up by Major General Melvin J. Moss, who was also a Minnesota congressman. He said when 250 patrol aircraft were produced and Washington ordered them sent to Britain, the admirals protested to FDR, who referred them to Hopkins. Hopkins received them as he lay in bed nonchalantly smoking a cigarette. He listened to them and then told them the interview was over and that he had already made the allocation. When Admiral Kimmel was told of this, he said, Admiral Kimmel told Congressman Moss that if those 250 patrol planes had been sent to Hawaii, the December 7th attack could never have succeeded and probably would never have been attempted. Incidentally, the estimates of the problem for Hawaii covering the area needed to protect it from air attack called for the use of 250 patrol planes. Kimmel had 36. We clearly see the importance of all this. I had to, you mentioned that Truman well, I can't remember what the context was. Truman,
he christened him Uncle Joe.
Yeah, okay, called him Uncle Joe. That was it. So the point that I wanted to make is that when Truman was a senator, actually in June of 41, Truman was quoted as saying, if we see that Germany is winning the war, we ought to help Russia. And if Russia is winning, we ought to help Germany.
Yeah.
And that way, let them kill as many as possible. I always thought that was pretty amazing, because obviously all of that changed later on. Admiral Stark, in a letter in July of 1941, writing to his friend, another admiral, Savvy Cook, he wrote, "We shall give aid to Russia." He's talking about Lend-Lease. "I hope Russia and Germany may break upon each other. Europe, dominated by the communists, is no more an attractive picture, and in fact less so, than a Europe dominated by the Nazis. Here's hoping we have neither.
That's right. You're quoting another, and that was Hiram Johnson, too, Senator Hiram Johnson, who also said essentially the same thing. You know, he said, where we are financing two cutthroats, you know, and he said, these guys were friends. You know, they had an alliance. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, well, incredible. All right. I guess we're running out of time here. There are more spies involved here.
Oh, sure.
They're Pearl Harbor-related spies. Anthony Blunt was one of the famous Cambridge spies. Guy Liddell, who was the head of MI5's counter-espionage, he wrote in his diary in August of 1941, we discussed the questions of British magic, they called them BJs, tried to press home my point that it was essential for us to have as much information as we could obtain. British magic was especially valuable since the Japanese expressed their innermost thoughts. It was for this reason that I, Guy Liddell, the director of MI5's counter-espionage, I had suggested Anthony Blunt should go down periodically to the government code and cipher school, that's the British NSA, and make notes. Mm-hmm. Make notes of the Japanese magic. Well, it doesn't take too much imagination to figure that Blunt is going to pass this information on to the Soviets. And, of course, I have a very personal experience with Soviet archivist Matryokin in The Sword and the Shield by Christopher Andrew, based on information smuggled out of Russia in the early 90s by KGB archivist, Matryokin, Vasily Matryokin. The claim is made that the Soviets independently broke into Japanese purple traffic, and these messages contributed to Stalin's decision to move troops from Far Eastern Asia to Moscow in November of 1941. Those messages are said to have been credible enough to convince the Soviets there would not be a Japanese attack on them. So here we have the bizarre situation of pretty compelling evidence that Stalin had access to magic. And, of course, the head of the Pacific Fleet doesn't even know what magic is.
Disgraceful.
My personal experience in this matter is that in the 1990s, when I was assistant agent in charge in Philadelphia, Vasily Matryokin's information, which he smuggled out of KGB archives, indicated that a spy in my territory then of Philadelphia, which included Minersville, Pennsylvania, we had a spy back in the 60s that we never could find. We were quite confident there was a spy there because Soviet illegals kept visiting the place, but we could never identify who it was. Well, Matryokin identified who it was and told us. It was a United States Army sergeant by the name of Robert Lipka who was stealing documents out of NSA, and these Soviet illegals were coming by Minersville and servicing Robert Lipka by paying him money while they collected the stolen NSA documents. And through some remarkable work by some very talented agents, 30 years after all this took place, more than 30 years, we were able to make a case against Robert Lipka. And I think he might still be in jail, but maybe not. Maybe he's gotten out by now. anyway, that certainly brings me to the point of personal verification of the importance of Matryokin's information. Mm-hmm. That was on a professional level. On a personal level, this idea that he's reporting that Stalin had access to magic is certainly worthy of note. I don't want you to leave. I assume we're ending this at 4. Is that right, Rick?
Yeah, we've got about 7 minutes or so, sure. No
okay,
more interruptions.
Well, British out of this thing. The British, they were compromised royally, literally royally, when the Japanese corrupted Frederick Joseph Rutland, who was a famous British naval officer, Royal Navy, who distinguished himself with the moniker Rutland of Jutland, because at the Battle of Jutland, he was the first to locate the German Navy. Therefore, the moniker Rutland at Jutland. Well, he was also a Japanese spy, a paid Japanese spy. And as if that wasn't cute enough, the fellow who determined this was Anthony Blunt. And Anthony Blunt has a memorandum in June of 1941 laying out how they came about to find that Rutland was a spy for the Japanese. And the reason the Japanese wanted him as spies, wanted Rutland as a spy, is because he was an accomplished aviator and very experienced with aircraft carrier operations. In fact, Rutland, as the story goes, was the first to land a plane on a Soviet, or rather on a Japanese aircraft carrier. Mm-hmm. And not only did we have the British war hero from World War I, Rutland, spying for the Japanese in World War II, prior to Pearl Harbor, we have Lord William Forbes Semple. He's also spying for the Japanese as a paid spy. But he is from the upper crust, and there was quite a scandal in the UK when this was determined, because it was one of the few black marks on Winston Churchill, who didn't take much action apparently against Lord Semple, mainly because he was of the proper breeding. There was a marvelous BBC discussion about this. I think it might still be available on the internet, called The Fall of Singapore, The Great Betrayal. Well, we don't need to stop there. One of the more intriguing Soviet cables that we broke partially states, according to our source in the FBI, this is a October 27th, 1944, New York KGB message. And it refers to our source in the Kata. Kata was code for FBI. Well, you can imagine that this sent FBI headquarters into a tizzy, thinking that there might be a Soviet source within the FBI. Now, this is back in 1944. The FBI, managed to rationalize this pretty good. We decided, no, there couldn't possibly be a source in the FBI. They must have meant Judith Copeland, C-O-P-L-O-N, who was another Soviet spy, but in the Department of Justice. Mm-hmm. So we pretty well satisfied ourselves that the Soviets didn't realize the difference between the FBI in the Department of Justice. I was never really very confident in that rationalization. But then again, that was long before my time.
You're right.
But the reason I went into that is because I had some responsibility for the FBI spy. His name is escaping me at the moment. The one just before Robert Hanson, Earl Pitts.
I had some
responsibility for trying to figure out how Earl Pitts had compromised us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I remember that in the Hanson case as well. One thing I want to do, Tom, is before you run out, just mention again, your email, I believe, is still thomaskkimmel@gmail.com. Is that right?
Well, it's actually Thomas K. Kimmel Jr., J.R., at gmail.com.
Okay. Right, yep. At Gmail. Now, what about the site, 9/11 Pearl Harbor Attacks?
Yeah, www.pearlharbor911attacks.com.
Okay, that's how you can go to Tom's site. And, yes, we only have about 2 or 3 minutes left, so I'll let you have the final few words in this fascinating program, Tom.
Well, the story of espionage continues apace. There's no doubt about it. I am fascinated with the current political agenda and how, if anything good is coming out of this collusion investigation of President Trump, it's the fact that we are being reawakened to what the Russians, because we can't say the Soviets anymore, what the Russians are capable of doing. The leopard clearly has not changed its spots. But the curious thing about this current interest in what the Russians are doing is the interest comes from the side of the House, which tries to minimize Venona and the previous corruption of Americans during the Roosevelt, Truman, and, as you point out, Eisenhower administrations.
Oh, yes. The egg on their face is too much. It's just too much to bear. Yes.
Well,
all political agendas. All of them political agendas. And I think Hoover would now be rolling over in his grave if he could see all of this.
I think you're... You know, I never served under Hoover. He deceased.
I know that.
I came in 1973. But,
right.
It took
that
us about 10 years.
After.
It really took us about 10 years to come to grips with the fact that Mr. Hoover was indeed deceased.
I understand. Yeah. Well, for all of his faults and everyone's faults, you know, he did bring forth quite a bit on the Pearl Harbor story in your case that I think. Only exemplifies the degree of corruption in Washington, and to try to bring in the FBI as a scapegoat as well as your grandfather and husband Short. These rascals will never quit. As you say, the enemy is within, Cicero. Any final word? Just one or two sentences, and we'll be out of time today, Tom.
Well, you have to recall that if Chairman Roberts had followed the investigative suggestions of Mr. Hoover, this whole thing would have been exposed immediately.
Amen.
No need for all the cover-up.
That is absolutely verifiably the truth, Tom, and I'm glad you said that. That's a good place to end. May I thank you again for being with us and sharing so much knowledge, and you keep up the good work. I promise you will be back again.
Thanks, Rick. Look forward to it.
Thank you. God bless. We'll be in touch. All right. Thank you, folks. Another fascinating program. And next week, we, God willing, will return. Until then, may Yahweh bless his elect.